As we record this program here in Central Iowa, we are just crawling out from under a pretty impressive blizzard. Howling winds, the gusts last night were over 50 miles per hour. We didn't get a lot of snow here. We kind of lucked out on, we dodged that bullet, but north of us, more than a foot, even 2 feet in some places. Gusts over 65 miles an hour. Yeah, a real genuine prairie blizzard. But, you know, we kind of expect this sort of thing in Des Moines, in Iowa, in the upper Midwest. But I was, you know, my wife and I have an urban farm, and there were a couple things I was concerned about. Well, always a little concerned about the bees, but, you know, they tend to be okay. They tend to hunker down, surround that queen, keep her at 92 degrees Fahrenheit. She's pretty picky, you know. And they usually make it through okay. I was concerned about our cold frames because I thought the wind might actually tear the glass panels off them. It was blowing so strong. I've had that happen once before. My biggest concern was the baby rat. We have baby rabbits just under 2 weeks old. And the mom laid them or birthed them outside of the nest for some reason. And I thought, well, they're going to be okay. And they were. They're fine. I counted four of them in there just now. They're all warm and cozy, despite it getting down to 8 degrees. So, yeah, bring on the blizzards. We can handle this. Although we're all very much ready for spring. So, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about our little urban farm here because, it survived the blizzard. It's survived heat waves. Although one of the biggest challenges, there are more and more big challenges. For example, crops not pollinating correctly because it gets too hot. Rabbits really struggling in the heat and needing fans and bottles of frozen water and constant monitoring of their temperature. But, you know, what we've been able to do here is create an ecosystem without chemicals or chemical fertilizers or pesticides. And it's a great place because it feeds us. I mean, between what we grow here and what we forage, Kathy and I get half of our food from that effort, which is, to me, very exciting because it's very high-quality food. But the other really neat thing about it is that we have created an environment. And it's very small. We don't have a lot of land. It's just a small holding, less than an acre. But we've created this intense habitat that is very attractive to birds, small mammals, some of them welcome, some of them not so much. Insects, again, some welcome, some not so much. But you can't pick and choose. An ecosystem is diverse. Everybody wants to eat. Some want to eat other people. Some want to eat other animals and birds and insects. You know, but it's. You know, I travel around the neighborhood or other parts of the city where you've got monoculture lawns or very sterile environments in front of people's homes or along the street, and you don't see that kind of bird activity. You know, sometimes I'm on a phone call out sitting in the garden, and this happens frequently, actually. Somebody, the person I'm talking with, will say, "Wow, what do you got going on there with all those birds?" I say, "Well, they like it here. They come here because we've got habitat, we've got food." And, you know, I know when you're involved in what's called production agriculture, you don't want any other life form taking any percentage of your crop at all, whether it's a fungus or a blight or a insect. You want it all for yourself. I get that. Especially with the margins in farming these days. I don't fault farmers for trying to make sure they have no competition for their product. We don't mind some competition. We don't mind sharing some of our lettuce, for example, with the occasional rabbit. We don't mind a few aphids. When they get to be an infestation, yeah, we get out the neem oil or the insecticidal soap. But, you know, some loss is going to come when you don't use chemicals. And that's okay. We still can produce 50% of what we eat. Yeah, bottom line is other creatures got to eat too. And, you know, creating an environment where they feel healthy and happy as well means you've got a place that's healthy and happy for you also. I want to share an Irish, again, St. Patrick's Week, so everything's Irish here today, right? Hey, So I want to share a message from Mary Reynolds. She's I've not heard of her till recently, but she's a fairly renowned landscape designer. Actually, I think she calls herself a recovering landscape designer. She's an author. She's a nature activist. She is from Wexford, Ireland. And she was known years ago, back in 2002, for being the youngest woman ever to win a gold medal at the Chelsea Flower Show. Okay, I hadn't heard of the Chelsea Flower Show either, but I guess it's fairly prestigious as far as flower shows go. She's an advocate for rewilding gardens, again, growing food, but also leaving plenty of habitat for nature to run its own course. She encourages biodiversity and, when possible, returning land to its native state. And she calls these places arcs. And I want to play a clip from one of her recent productions.
Through Irish mythology, we are left messages, warnings. The old stories show us that regimes and cultures rise and fall repeatedly, that sovereignty is lost when the world falls out of balance with nature. We often hear about the future possibility of collapse these days. Collapse in society, ecology, and climate. But collapse, according to our ancestors, is not the end of the world. It's a cycle, a wave. And restoration only comes through returning to right relationship with the land. Across Irish mythology, these collapse patterns emerge again and again through the loss of sovereignty. They appear when leaders break their promise to care for the land and her people, when taking without tending becomes normalized, when boundaries are violated, and most importantly, when truth is abandoned. The myths tell us that when these laws are ignored, the land becomes barren, crops fail, people and the natural world grow sick, and the society, the order, begins to fray. These stories return again and again, not as prophecies, but as warnings encoded as story. And here we are. Very few people are telling the truth these days. The media and political players, our leaders, are following the same arc described in these warning stories. Breaking promises, taking without return, and reshaping truth into a weapon. Something to be punished if spoken, and suppressed at all costs. We are not facing into a crisis. We are living through one. It is unfolding before us. Irish mythology also shows us what happens next. When the world becomes hostile to the old ways, life withdraws into refuge. Like the Tuatha De Danann, the spirit of the land doesn't disappear, it retreats into hidden pockets, waiting for the time it can return. When humans forget they belong to the land doesn't die. It removes itself from them. Irish mythology never predicted an apocalypse. It warned us about what happens when we break our bond with the land. And it reminds us that life survives by retreating into the places where it is still honored. Our arcs are not going to solve everything, but they matter. They are places of retreat, where nature can still hold her ground, where she can continue in whatever ways remain possible. Small patches of living refusal, places where life can wait. Seeds of restoration placed gently into a damaged world, so that something can still grow again when the time is right. When we remember how to go back into right relationship with this beautiful planet.
I found that very moving, very compelling, and very appropriate again from an Irish woman talking to us during St. Patrick's Week. So Reynolds talks about building an arc, or building lots of little arcs, about rewilding. And again, you know, again, here's my thought. You know, Kathy and I live in the heart of Des Moines. That's Iowa's largest city. It's also the fastest growing urban area in the Midwest, which I'm not particularly happy or excited about. But, you know, much of the countryside in Iowa is so altered. And again, I'm not blaming farmers. It's a system set up that has trapped people in this approach to managing the land that is not sustainable. And there's a lot of pushback happening right now. But in the meantime, we've had a countryside that's so altered. Yeah, sure, there's still deer and raccoon out there and other animals, but gosh, a lot of them have moved to the city. you see all these animals here in the city. Foxes, owls, possum, raccoon, deer. They're all thriving here, more than a lot of people would like. but you know, much of their natural habitat has been plowed under. And, you know, there's zero diversity across thousands of acres of land in rural Iowa. And so, and this is not, I joke about that. I say, you know, maybe we should urbanize all of Iowa. No, I'm totally kidding. But maybe we should begin to find out how we can create better spaces that are both productive in terms of, you know, producing food and other basic needs for humanity, but also that don't discourage other wildlife, other life forms from thriving. And we've seen a drastic drop in the number of insect populations. Bird populations have also plummeted. Those are not good signs. I mean, what Mary Reynolds is saying about that is accurate. You know, and also part of it is who owns the land. You know, more and more it is owned by absentee landlords, out-of-state billionaires like Bill Gates. Bill Gates owns 275,000 acres of farmland in 18 different states. On top of that, you've got foreign investors who now own 45 million acres of U.S. farmland. So there's an ownership problem. There's a problem of how the government intervenes in the market to make it very difficult to do anything other than what the big corporate interests want. A lot of that has to do up here with corn and soybeans, hogs and cattle. Anyway, it's changing, and we have to do our little part to change it. And, you know, as Reynolds was saying, you know, take your little piece of land, whether it's a farm or an acreage, or in our case, less than an acre, or southern windows in your apartment, you know, and try to create that space where life can thrive. And you can get some personal benefit in terms of food out of it, in terms of beauty, and maybe it can benefit some other life forms as well. Now, I want to, again, this being St. Patrick's Week, I want to talk a little bit about my least favorite Englishman of all time, and it's a long list, Oliver Cromwell. In the 1600s, for a span of time, he invaded Ireland to subdue it. I mean, the subduing of Ireland had already been underway, but the Irish kept fighting back. Cromwell came in, and an estimated 200,000 to 600,000 Irish people died through either the war or subsequent famine and plague. There are these monsters throughout history. Vlad the Impaler, Attila the Hun, Adolf Hitler, of course, Joseph Stalin. You know, they're monsters, and they did horrible things to the people and to the land, and yet we have survived. The Irish survived. Now have their own country, most of it. The earth has survived. This time is different. I don't know. It's, you know, it is different now. It's very intense. I mean, we have climate change. We have weapons of mass destruction, not just nuclear, but chemical and biological. And we have this new threat of AI. Yeah, I mean, it often seems like we might not make it through this. But again, I go back to Ireland. 600 years of British occupation and oppression, and many people during that time had no hope. But there was always a group of patriots that fought back. You know, and it wasn't just the people, too. The people were oppressed, but also remember, Ireland used to be covered with forest. About, 80% of the country was forested. But the trees were also cut down about the same time Cromwell invaded by the English. So, you know, but a core of people have kept resisting and finally accomplished independence in 1922. And there are those who are now pushing for more reforestation, including myself. I've been doing my part to try to encourage that. So the important message here is that don't give up. You know, when you quit believing that we have a future, and especially when you quit fighting against the forces that want to destroy the future and all that's good and just in the world, that's when despair sets in, and that's when the hopelessness that we see so much of these days takes root. You know, it poisons your whole being. It poisons the world around you, and we have to not let that happen. We have to not let that. That's when the oppressors win, when despair sets in. So I believe it was Joan Baez who used to say, action is the antidote to despair. And she would say that to encourage people to take action, you know, against injustice, against, you know, against war. And it's a great quote. It's one I use a lot. Like Mary Reynolds, again, if you do what you can, if you've got a little piece of land or a window, whatever it is, bring life to that place. And not just some, you know, crappy grass that is sold to you under the illusion that a perfectly green lawn is the way to go. Yeah, maybe you have some of that, because it is nice to go sit on a green lawn. I get that. But, you know, diversity. We need diversity in our communities, in our lives, for me, in my music, and certainly in our environment. We need diversity. I guess to use Mary Reynolds' expression, make an ark. You know, make your ark. And again, this won't be like the ark in the Bible. That's a story. We're dealing with real stuff right now. But, you know, but again, don't just stop at building your own ark or maybe working to, I mean, I know people who are working to rid our forests, our parks of invasive species, all great stuff. But remember, take the time to also engage with the world around you, with the policies that need to be changed, with the people that need to be in power to make the changes that we need. You know, again, action is the antidote to despair. Thank you, Joan Baez. But that action cannot just be in your own little bubble. Build that ark, but also help the rest of the world. You know, make sure we've got that structure in place that is going to be as resilient as possible as the terrible stuff that's happening continues to move forward. I have no doubt that we haven't reached the bottom of this yet. Just be honest about that. We haven't reached the bottom of this yet. But remember the resilience of the Irish and the resilience of other indigenous and native peoples in our own land and around the world. And it really is the wisdom and tradition and perspective of native communities that has been the answer to war and oppression and injustice in the past. And I think that, you know, going forward, we will rely more and more heavily on their perspectives. And for me, a lot of that involves my perspective as an Irish American with strong connections to the homeland. I'm going to leave you with another recording here. This is Christy Moore singing Irish Ways and Irish Laws. And we'll go from that into a break and be back with you a few minutes after that with more conversation on the Fallon Forum.
Once upon a time there was Irish ways and Irish laws, villages of Irish blood, waken to the morning, waken to the morning. Then the Vikings came around, turned us up and turned us down, started building boats and towns. They tried to change our living, tried to change our living. Cromwell and his soldiers came, started centuries of shame. But they could not make us turn. We are a river flowing. We're a river flowing. Again, again the soldiers came, burnt her houses, stole our grain, shot the farmers in their fields, working for a living, working for a living. Eight 800 years we have been down, the secret of the water sound has kept the spirit of a man above the pain descending, above the pain descending. Today the struggle carries on. I wonder, will I live so long to see the gate being opened up to a people and their freedom, a people and their freedom. Once upon a time there was Irish ways and Irish laws.